Freedom 106.5 FM. Speak your mind.
Welcome back. We continue our discussions. Of course, the budget presentation gets going just after 1:30 this afternoon. We'll have live coverage for you right here on Freedom 106.5 FM. Joining us, a gentleman who's been with us on numerous occasions before. Definitely looking for some of his input, insight to what's going to happen a little later today. Let's welcome back to our program, Dr. Val McKay-Aldrin. Good morning to you. Welcome to our show.
Hi, good morning, and good morning to all your viewers. Thank you very, very much for having me on the program today.
It's nice to have you here this morning. The hot button topic that's on the lips of everyone, it seems. We'll get into the other issues related to the budget, but let's start off with this thing about minimum wage. And people have been talking about minimum wage, the pros, the cons. Some people want it, some people don't care to hear about it, some people need it. Let's hear from you. Let's talk about minimum wage. Is it much ado about nothing? Is it important? Is it going to bog down businesses? What's really the deal with this thing? Is it that we're making too much out of nothing? Or are these concerns justified with this minimum wage?
No, I think the concerns are quite justified. I think in Trinidad and Tobago, we are quite lackadaisical with how we treat minimum wage. The cost of living, as we're all aware, has surged in recent years, more so because since the pandemic and thereafter. But we could even go before that. Remember that when you look at what we consume on a daily basis, the commodity then that we consume the most of on a daily basis, that is food, right? The prices of food would have increased by about 31% in the last 5 years. And I mean, I can get into food prices and whatnot, but I wouldn't go down that angle just as yet. About at this particular moment, minimum wage is about $17.50. Now, when we look at the data from the CSO, and this is only the data dealing with the legitimate economy, $17.50 gives you about 28 per hour if you're assuming that you work about an 8-hour day and a 5-day week. That basically gives you $700 per week, so it's about $2,800 per month. Now, according to the CSO data, about 51,400 persons make that money. Now, in the grand scheme of our population, someone might hear that figure and think, well, it's not that much, but it actually is quite a lot of persons. I mean, over 50,000 people, in my view, is a significant portion. And when you consider that some of these people, or many of them, belong to a household where that individual might be the only person working and has to take care of a wife, some children, then it really begs the question, how are they making ends meet given the surge in our living costs in the last few years? Now, the other angle that one has to consider is that there may be more persons making at least that amount of money, or they could probably be making less, but they're working in the parallel market, in the underground economy, as we see in economics, where businesses, or they're working for an entity that is not registered and not paying taxes, so it basically falls under the radar, at least for now. So in such an instance, that individual could be making $17.50 an hour, he could be making a bit more, or what tends to happen is that they're making much less. In fact, there are people working in some businesses that are making about probably $12 an hour, if not less. So one has to consider, in the grand scheme of things, given the not just the surge in the cost of living, but the fact of the matter is that we have not had an increase in the minimum wage for quite some time, that it is from that angle warranted that there should be an increase in the minimum wage. What that increase is, however, then that is a completely different question. Given that you have to find a balancing act with respect to the increase in the wage relative to what our productivity levels has been in the country, and especially in the most recent time, and what is likely to be going forward when this minute, when this, if and when this wage is bumped up. Because remember, when you increase the minimum wage, that means that you're giving a certain segment of the population an increase in their purchasing power. When you increase your purchasing power, then of course you have more money to spend. But if the quantum of goods and services available in the country to spend that money on does not increase at the same time, so in other words, if your production levels are not increasing or your productivity levels are not increasing, then it's basically a greater purchasing power available for the same quantity of goods and services. So let me just break it down a bit easier for the listener. If a country is producing 10 oranges, and then the population in that country, a segment of them, their income levels go up, but you're still only producing 10 oranges, then there's going to be much more competition for those said 10 oranges, right? So the prices of those 10 oranges are therefore going to increase, and that is likely to happen if and when the wage level increase, if it is a bit too high. So that is what the authorities need to be very careful of. In increasing this particular wage, you want to make sure that the rate of increases, the percentage rate of increases is not higher or does not exceed our productivity levels. And that is going to require those at the BIR and the Ministry of Finance, to the technocrats there, to make that particular calculation and come up with the ideal balance that is not going to cause a drastic increase in our inflation.
Mm.
I think that is one of the main concerns that everyone has, and it is quite a justified concern.
Now,
with respect to the private sector, however, could they afford to pay this? Now, we've heard from many, many groups, certain chambers of commerce, etc., that they do have a concern as to the timing of any increase to the minimum wage, because as we're aware, many companies, more so the micro and small enterprises, a lot of them are still undergoing a great deal of financial stress since the pandemic. I mean, I can tell you, being one of the directors in the Shawanas Chamber, we hear it every week. There are a lot of businesses that are still clamoring to get to hold their operations together because of the financial strain that the pandemic has put them in, even though we've been somewhat out of the pandemic stage since last year. Now, can they afford to pay this minimum wage? Again, it is going to depend on the level. Some of them may not be able to pay it at all. Some of them are struggling right now to pay their workers. So what could very well happen is that an increase in the minimum wage, while it is a positive gesture, it could very well backfire in that some companies could say, look, I can't afford to pay you any longer. So if I have to adhere with this new minimum wage legislation, then I'll have to give you less working hours to be able to keep you on the books. Or at some point in time, they could very well lay off the individual and assign that individual's responsibility to another person who is working in the company, but without increasing that person's salary at the same time, even though you're giving them more work to do. The other thing is that if someone gets laid off from their position, then remember that individual is on a lower income bracket. It is highly likely that individual, as we say in economics, is of a low-skilled type individual, which means that it could become even more difficult for that individual to go out there and get a job. So what does he do? He turns to the parallel market, where you have to work for entities that are below the radar and are not registered entities. And that in itself could make the situation worse, because even though there is a minimum wage legislation, he now has to, what is likely, to face an employer who's telling you, look, I can hire you, yes, but you're not going to get minimum wage. You're going to get something lower. You might get about $12 or $15 an hour. And of course, we're not going to be paying you any NIS. And at the end of the day, you as an employee are also going to fall below the radar in terms of your rights as an employee as well, because you're working for an unregistered entity. So at the end of the day, you're settling for less. So these are some of just some of the ways in which the minimum wage issue can in fact backfire if you don't strike the right balance, first and foremost. And most important, and what is also equally important, is that we don't aggressively push the drive to make sure that there are proper checks and balances, that this TTRA entity or whichever entity that, or the entity that they are creating to ensure that there are less and less unregistered businesses in the country, and this gap in the parallel market is closed as much as possible. Because this is certainly a way that having a parallel market and many companies that are going under the radar, that they're unregistered and they don't have proper tax compliance, this is another way in which it backed this issue of the minimum wage increase is, it could very well backfire. So this is something that the TTRA, the upcoming TTRA or the BIR, needs to be very, 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 very vigilant about.
Yeah. So let's paint a scenario. I say to you, Dr. Arjun, I'm making you finance minister, and I want you to make pronouncements on what should happen with the minimum wage, whether we should increase it, what we should increase it to. What would be your perspective?
Well, like as I indicated, I do think it should be increased given the extent of the increase in the cost of living within the last few years. I mean, let me give you some information here as we're on the air. And this information is publicly available on the Ministry of Trade's website. What they do, they survey supermarkets every month and report prices of certain major supermarkets in every zone within the country. So you have in East Trinidad, Central, South, North, etc. So I just looked at the supermarkets in Central Trinidad. And between 2019, just before the pandemic, till now, till the most recent information they have, which is September 2023, between then, certain basic food items, the price increases are quite significant. Cheddar cheese, for example, the price of that went up by about 27%. One of the cheaper margarines, Blue Band, the price of that went up by 66%. Eggs, a dozen eggs went up by 25%. Macaroni, and it went up by about 46%. Ibis flour went up by 37%. Tuna went up by 10%. Vienna sausages went up by 6%. A tin of corned beef went up by 41%. A pack of Milo went up by 32%. Red beans went up by 37%. Chicken breast went up by 48%. And that is just a short list of items that people purchase sometimes on a weekly basis, sometimes on a fortnightly basis, etc., to be able to feed their families. Basic food items that people use to feed their families. So, as I indicated earlier, the commodity that all of us consume the most of on a daily basis is food. The lower income brackets spend at least, according to the IDB, about 46% of their income on food alone. So if I were a Minister of Finance, I certainly would give an increase in the minimum wage. But what I would do differently is every 2 years, I would re-examine that minimum wage to determine if it is adequate enough. Because let's face the reality, there is a significant portion of our population that are vulnerable, and that vulnerability has certainly grown since the pandemic. And you want to protect the vulnerable, but you also want to move them out of a state of vulnerability. So every 2 years, I would re-examine what this minimum wage ought to be, with the intention of either keeping it fixed or, depending on the cost of living at that point in time, together with the productivity levels in the country at that point in time, to see is our economy growing, at which sectors are growing, how much are we growing? Because if it's 1 or 2%, then that's still very meager, it's marginal. Then, taking all these factors into consideration, I would then make a decision together with my team of technocrats whether the minimum wage should go up. We don't want to push it down, whether it will go up, and if it should go up, by how much it is going to go up. Again, taking into account that if you push it up by too much, it could lead to some businesses, it could lead to backfiring where some businesses could very well fold their hands and say, look, I can't afford to pay you, so I have to let you go. Or it simply leads to another scenario where the inflation level in the country gets much higher. And you want to avoid that from happening, especially at this stage when we have a very high cost of living happening right now.
So the question is, do we increase the minimum wage or not? And if we do...
Yeah, we certainly do. We certainly should increase the minimum wage. What that increase ought to be, that is where the technocrats at the Ministry of Finance need to do their proper analyses and come up with an adequate value.
Okay, let's leave the Ministry of Finance out of this. And let's get from your analysis of the situation and all the trends that you've identified and everything else. If there is to be an increase, as you're suggesting, there must or there should be, what should that increase be? Because we need to hear from, we have a lot of trade unionists and people who have no idea about all of these intricate details that you're talking about, making pronouncements about $30 an hour and $25 an hour, giving people unrealistic expectations. You have the knowledge, the expertise, the training, and to be able to analyze and project properly. What do you think a minimum wage should be?
So I don't have the access to the level of data that those at the Ministry of Finance would have access to.
Mm-hmm.
The data that I have access to is information that is available on the CSO for the entire public to see, and of course the Ministry of Trade's website, etc. Now, recently, and I know the opposition leader would have indicated that we should bring the minimum wage up to, I think it was $24-$25 an hour, something that would bring the monthly income up to about $4,000. Or thereabouts. Now, if you were to bring it up to that level, then it means that about 90,200 persons, again, in the legitimate economy, would be making that particular salary. So, again, that is still a smaller portion in the legitimate economy, but nonetheless, it's still quite a sizable amount of persons when you consider that individual has to feed not only himself, but a spouse, children, etc. Now, I think when the talk came up, one of the figures that came to my mind instantly, right? And again, this is without doing any
right.
But this is without having any level of data that those technocrats in the Ministry of Finance would have. I thought that at the first stages, you're hearing reports in newspapers that it could very well go up to about 1950. I still think that's a bit low. I think if you want to push it up in the initial stages to about 2150, that to me could be a better compromise than where we are at right now. But again, we need to do a proper analysis using the right quantum of data that the Ministry of Finance will have access to. They need to do their analyses and their studies to come up with an adequate amount. It's not a situation where the Minister of Finance can wake up one morning and say, look, I'm going to increase it to $25 or I'm going to increase it to $21.50. It doesn't work like that. They have to do a proper study to determine what this wage level should be so that it does not exceed greatly, or at least greatly exceed what our productivity levels are in the country, or what they're likely to be in the future, because that is just going to cause even more inflationary concerns.
That's an interesting figure that you put forward, $21.50. And you've justified your reasoning. To many people, that would seem to be, as you've rightly described it, a compromise from what some of the figures being bandied about, probably what the ministry thinks businesses can afford. As to whether or not we'll see anything close to that, I doubt very much. It seems to be the trend that increases in the minimum wage are adopted by a $2 figure, because we went from 15 to 17, so it stands to reason that they might increase it by $2 again. In the greater scheme of things, as you've outlined, the cost of living has gone up, and you've highlighted the cost for basic food items aside and apart from everything else, because apart from food, you would have other increases like transportation and electricity and water and everything else coming in one. So we've spent a considerable amount of time on the minimum wage, which is really where the majority of focus is. It doesn't seem as though people are expecting any kind of increase in fuel prices or anything along those lines.
I doubt he's going to increase fuel prices because it appears as though they have the fuel subsidy under control. I mean, oil prices have gone up. They're probably, from what we're seeing right now in the international market, oil prices could very well cross $100 per barrel. But I doubt even at that particular stage, the minister is likely to increase the fuel prices at the pump because of them having subsidy under control, at least for now.
Mm.
I'd be very, very surprised if he pushed up that fuel price. But then again, what we have to consider is that this is not his last budget before the elections. This is the second to last budget. So I think, you know, we shouldn't put our heads in the sand then and bury our heads in the sand to think that he's not necessarily going to make a couple of things even more difficult in terms of the cost of living. That shouldn't surprise us if he does, because he has one more budget as a sweetener than before the elections. This is not necessarily going to be the sweetener budget.
So
just to keep that in mind.
So basically, if harsh or unpopular moves need to be made, this is the budget to do it.
Pretty much. This is the budget to do it because he has one more again, unless you know, there is something in the horizon that we're not seeing coming of an early the elections. There's one more budget likely to happen after this in 2024 at the very least.
Yeah.
If they call a late elections in 2025, that is. So which I doubt is going to happen. So this is not going to be the sweetener budget. We shouldn't think that this is going to be a budget filled with sweeteners, because it's not.
You know, it's interesting. We had a discussion some time ago about the politics of economics. And you can't get away from that in these discussions, that politics seems to trump economics when it comes to making some of the decisions that happen for something as important as a national budget. But we'll get to that and a lot more in the 8 o'clock hour, because we do have some messages to take us up to the news. And when we get back after the 8 o'clock news, we will want to delve a bit deeper into some of the challenges that the country has faced in the past financial year and how that's going to factor into any of the decisions made planning moving forward. Some of the positives as well. For those of you now joining us, we are speaking this morning, pre-budget, Dr. Valmiki Arjun. We'll be taking some of your calls as well on the other side of 8 o'clock. Some messages to take us up to the top and to news. Stay with us. The final hour of our show here this morning, continuing our discussion with our special guest, Dr. Valmiki Arjun. We will take some of your calls if you'd like to join the conversation. And I've got a couple messages. Let me just read a bit of those. One saying, so in other words, the population should be demanding to see the report that was done already. Another one, the policies of this budget are a direct result of the past 7 years. We have to choose quality of life and economics over politics. Another one, good morning, Mark. My words, we're going to live a good life for the next year. Elections are around the corner. Good morning. Oh, this is in relation, I'll tell you all about that a little later on. A lot of people say $25 an hour is a minimum wage. Good morning. Thank you for a great program. Lots of supermarket and retail workers in pain, living on minimum wage or less. Another one, good morning, doubles workers working for minimum wage, they don't pay taxes. Another one, grocery workers work for minimum wage, just as laborers. Let's take a call or two before we get back into our discussion with our special guest. Hello, good morning.
Morning, Satish.
Good morning to you.
And morning to your guest, Mr. Valmiki. Are you still there?
Yes, he is.
Yes, morning, Mr. Arjun.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Yeah, Mr. Arjun, as a citizen of this country, I'm calling from Princeton. I am angered, stressed by our politicians, our leaders, our successive governments who have brought this country to where we are today. I mean, today's budget, yes, very important, very significant. But how long are we going to sit down on our laurels, intellectually and otherwise, and wait for conflicts in the Middle East and the Ukraine war for blood to flow, for us to get increases in gas and oil prices? And then we boast about economic management and wealth and distribution, and we have a good time, etc., while neglecting the fundamentals of proper economic development and management. I mean, this budget today, is it how much, what percentage or proportion of this budget is more politics than sound economic figures and policies and ideas and perspectives? How much of this budget is about truth? Are they going to report on their performance on the last previous budget, a couple of years and so on. Is the budget linked to any kind of real ideology, philosophy, in terms of governance, long-term and so on? Where are we really heading? It cannot be this hand-to-mouth kind of economics and politics that we have been subjected to in this country must be exposed and unmasked and condemned.
Okay, all right, thank you so much. Callers, please try to make it short so we can get as many calls in. Today, tomorrow we could talk forever. Hello, good morning. Hello, good morning. Okay, thank you so much. We're not hearing you. Dr. Arjun, politics and economics. In this country, both are married. That's one for sure. But which trumps which in most instances, do you think?
I think in countries like Trinidad and Tobago, political favors tend to trump economic expediency all the time. And when you consider the fact that, I mean, Kuala said something very interesting, that, you know, you do they paint, or you suggested if they're, you know, you're painting a real picture. And I just want to clarify something here. In the last, I'm not even going back 10 years because the figures will be worse, right? I'm going back 5 years, just 5 years. In the last 5 years, we spent $37 billion more than what we actually earned in revenues. Now, understand this figure. This is $37 billion more than what we actually earned in revenues. That is our fiscal deficit in the last 5 years. Now, when you have a deficit, it means that you haven't earned enough money to pay your bills. So then, in that case, if you think about it, if you haven't earned enough money to pay your bills, what do? You go on and take out debt. That extra $37 billion that was spent that we didn't earn back in revenues to cover the cost, the government would have taken out additional debt to pay those bills or liabilities that they would have owed. So our debt burden would have increased by, at the very least, $37 billion on that particular, and over the course of that five-year period. Notwithstanding, however, they would have, you know, paid off some previous debt burdens from earlier years, etc. But to finance a deficit, a fiscal deficit, you do have to take on additional debt to pay off that deficit, those monies you would. You wouldn't hear anybody, any finance minister, talking about that in a national budget. I'm sure he is going to say today he's going to focus on the fact that the economy has returned to positive growth. Yes, there's no doubt about it. We have returned to positive growth in the first quarter of this year. Information from the CSO shows that the economy in the first quarter of this year grew by about 3%, just over 3%. Last year, the IMF is telling us that last year the economy grew by 2.5%. But what he will not tell you is that since 2015, the economy declined by 20%. What he will not tell you is that, yes, we're growing right now. But when you calculate those growth figures, those annual growth figures, that means that in 2022, you are comparing it to our economic performance in 2021 to see how well we grew from 21 to 22. And in 21, our circumstances were very dire because of the pandemic. We had reached quite a significantly low level in terms of our economic performance. Now, obviously, as the saying goes, if you hit rock bottom, there's only one place you can go, and that's up. Now, I would hope that our circumstances then is rock bottom and we can never do worse than that. However, obviously, you reach the bottom of the barrel, then you're going upwards thereafter. So obviously, we would report positive growth figures afterwards. But it is more intuitive to compare our performance not to during the pandemic, but more so in the immediate pre-pandemic period in 2019. And if we look at our performance from 2019 till the end of 2022, we would have seen that the economy would have declined by over 6.3%. So relative to where we were before the pandemic, the economy is still in a worse-off position. Now compare that to other countries in the Caribbean region. In the Caribbean region, you have, let's say, Jamaica. Jamaica is likely to exceed their pre-pandemic level by about 0.1% this year. St. Lucia will exceed their pre-pandemic level of performance by about 0.4% this year. If you want to, let's consider Bahamas as well. Bahamas, I think, has already surpassed their pre-pandemic performance levels. And these are other Caribbean economies that traditionally have not been as strong as Trinidad and Tobago in terms of our economic performance. And, you know, I have this thing about comparing our performance to other Caribbean countries because their economic circumstances are a bit different from ours. So let's compare ourselves to countries where that have similar economic characteristics, like our GDP per capita. Chile has a similar GDP per capita to ours. Chile recovered from the pandemic since 2021 in terms of their economic performance. They would have surpassed their economic performance since about a year after the pandemic started. So this year, they are poised to grow by about 6% relative to where they were in 2019. These are things that you're not going to hear in the national budget. So they may tell us that, yes, the economy is growing. We've turned around the corner. We've turned around the economy and all these frivolous things that you hear the Minister of Finance saying all the time. Well, those things, you know, when you realistically think where we are today and what the average householder and the average small businessman has to endure on a daily basis, no, the economy has not turned around. Because of the significant obstacles to doing business, the significant obstacles to the competitiveness of the private sector, the fact that there's severe inaccessibility of foreign exchange in the country, the fact that we have very subpar energy production levels for several years now, and the fact that there's growing levels of poverty and inequality in the country, we've still not caught on to where we were back in 2019. We're very, very far off from where we were at the end of 2015, 2016, and we're likely to be in that position for several years well into the future.
Mm. So, I understand what you're saying. While there may be positive, the positives take us nowhere close to where we were. So we're still very much in a bad situation. If not a bad situation, not necessarily the situation that we want to be in. Let's take a couple more calls because there are some specific things that we probably need to touch on, such as where we see our energy sector factoring in. What size of a budget are we expecting this time around? Hello, good morning.
Morning, Satish, and morning to Mr. Arjun. Mr. Arjun, I want to talk energy because it seems to be the only thing that this country, the driving force of the economy, energy, natural gas and oil and whatnot. What can the government do and what have they not done in the last 8 years to increase our energy production, that is natural gas and oil? And we know we always talk about agriculture. Is agriculture, how to put it, what can the government do to also bring up the level of agriculture as the United States? And should they subsidize farmers in agriculture? And do you recommend, last question, do you recommend that Trinidad build nuclear plants in Trinidad to supply the population with energy so that we can export our natural gas and oil? Thanks a lot.
Mm, thank you so much for your call, Dr. Arjun.
So the world is actually moving towards greener sources of energy in terms of the renewables, in terms of solar and wind, etc. Green hydrogen to produce green hydrogen. So I think that is direction that we ought to be moving on. But let me just backtrack a bit. What drives our energy sector is more so gas than oil. But when we look at the figures, we would see that over the last 10 years, our gas production declined by about 36%. And that in turn would have caused our liquefied natural gas production to decline by about 46%. Oil production in that same period declined by about 31%. And again, this is over a 10-year period. So right now, our oil production is about just in the vicinity of about 56,000 barrels a day. When you compare that to where we were in 2013, we were producing back then about 81,000 barrels per day. Gas production today right now is about 2.6 billion standard cubic feet per day. 2013, we were about on average, we were about 4.1 billion standard cubic feet per day. And I think it would have peaked in 2013 and 2014 at about 4.4 billion standard cubic feet. So these are staggeringly different figures. Now, to put it into context, how much gas we really need in Trinidad and Tobago every day to meet our local needs, our local demand. Before the closure of Atlantic LNG Train 1, we would have needed about, on average, about 4 billion standard cubic feet per day just for our own local needs. For the Atlantic trains, for TNTech, for our electricity generation, and for the industrial plants at Point Lisas. However, because of the closure of Train 1, that figure has now dropped from about 4 billion standard cubic feet to about 3.5 billion standard cubic feet. So that is really how much we need per day for our own local needs. However, production is about 2.5 billion per day. So we're in a deficit in our gas production of about 1 billion standard cubic feet per day. That's where we are right now. So obviously our gas production has been languishing for some time. And what's the reason for this? Much of our reserves lie in the deep water, not necessarily. I mean, we do have reserves in shallow water, yes, but much of our proven reserves are in the deep water. The last deep water bid rounds before the most recent one, so I should say the second to last one, was I think back in 2013 or 2014, somewhere around then. And recently we had one in 2022 where 17 deep water blocks were on offer. Out of that, 4 bids were given. So 4 bids on 17 deep water blocks. And out of those 4 bids, 3 blocks were awarded to the BP Shell Consortium. So that's 3 blocks being awarded for exploration and developmental activities. 3 blocks out of 17. Now compare that to 2012, when the investment environment was very different and you had 12 bids being placed for 5 deep water blocks on offer. So what do I mean by the investment environment is different? Now, first and foremost, energy companies so far for several years now, what they've been doing in the deep water is simply developing existing fields. But fields are maturing, meaning that over time, the amount of gas that they would tend to provide is going to reduce. So as fields mature and new fields happen to come on stream, one is going to offset the other. The maturing field is going to offset at least some of the new gas that the new fields are providing. So that's one of the reasons that our gas production has not been so encouraging thus far. But more importantly, there was a need for more aggressive performance in the bid rounds, so the bid rounds to become more competitive. Now, why were the most recent bid rounds not so competitive? You know, we always hear the politicians, both on the UNC and the PNM side, talk about the fiscal incentives. A former energy minister, Kevin Ramnarayanan, he talks about it a lot, the need for fiscal incentives. And he's absolutely correct. Last year, you would have seen the Minister of Finance bring on additional fiscal incentives for the energy sector. One of them being, of course, a drop in the petroleum profits taxation rate of 35 from 35% down to 30% for those involved in deep water exploration activities. Now, that in itself appears to not have been adequate because we only had 4 bids for 17 deep water blocks, which is not very much. So this clearly shows that the investment environment is more difficult than it was back in the era of a decade ago, 2012, 2013, that particular period. And why is the investment environment more difficult? Deep water exploration is much more capital intensive, much more significantly more expensive than shallow water exploration. So because of the cost factor involved, the energy companies are going to require a much larger rate of return, a much larger return for their investment. because we are competing for the money, the capital of the energy company, that same capital that they could take, that BP could take to another jurisdiction, a shallow water jurisdiction where the cost involved is not that high and where they can earn things like economies of scale, which is lower cost of production. So what then, how can we incentivize them to make sure that that same money that they could use elsewhere on those shallow water, low cost jurisdictions, that those same funds are kept here in Trinidad and Tobago? Because of the high cost factor involved, you have to incentivize them properly so they can make sure that they recoup, that not that they don't just recoup their investment, but that they earn a very high, an adequately high rate of return on their investment as well. In addition to this, a lot of these energy companies are making investments in green energy and renewables energy. So we are actually competing for that same capital as well. The same money that they're using, that they could be using for green energy, again, we have to incentivize them so that they keep those investments here for deep water exploration, as opposed to spending it for green or renewable sources of energy. We also have to consider that interest rates internationally are very high. And these energy companies, they don't just rely on their own company's funds. Many times they take loans from the international banks. But the international banks are actually looking at higher interest rates for these hydrocarbons, these oil and gas projects, as opposed to the interest rates that they're charging on companies who are involved in green energy investments. They would more than likely charge those companies lower interest rates. So if a bank, of course, charges the energy company a high interest rate for them to get money to go into deep water exploration, obviously they need a rate of return that is going to help them to not just repay that high rate of interest, but at the end of the day, have some money left over for themselves as well. You see, banks have what we call the environmental, social, and corporate governance, the ESG. There's a lot of talk about ESG in this day and age. Banks have this ESG standards that they have to meet locally and internationally. And part of their mandate for ESG is to reduce the hydrocarbon investments and move more into green technology and green energy investments. So all of these factors considered means that the cost involved of deep water is being pushed up even further. So we have to come up with a proper fiscal regime in the budget that is going to be very attractive for the energy companies to get them to invest more in our deep water exploration and development, and thereafter production levels. Because gas underground, gas at the bottom of the ocean or underneath the seabed is useless. It has no value. It only has value when it is brought above ground and we are able to liquefy it in Atlantic LNG for exports, or send it to the downstreamers in Point Lisas for the petrochemical sector to develop and to export as well, and also, of course, to provide for our own national, our own local needs. If you don't bring it above ground, it is useless. So what do we do then? Well, how do we properly incentivize these energy companies to ensure that they take their monies and make the investment to get this gas above ground? Now, I just want to touch on the Dragon Field issue for a bit, because, I mean, it's ironic. Just before the budget, you hear that they've signed a deal between with Venezuela, a profit-sharing arrangement. But, of course, a lot of the details of this profit-sharing arrangement is still shrouded in a lot of secrecy, because up to now, we don't know what are the terms of the profit-sharing arrangement, how much, what percentage is TNT getting as opposed to Venezuela. U.S. sanctions still stipulate that President Maduro, PDVSA, the state oil company in Venezuela, and Venezuela as a whole, should not gain financially from any of this. So that is a big spoke, a huge spoke in this deal. So I'm not sure what they're doing to circumvent that or move around that, because it is highly unlikely that Maduro is going to want payment in any form other than U.S. currency. What are the production sharing arrangements? What are the taxation and royalties arrangements? What arrangements do they have to ensure that the labor and equipment can move from one border, the Trinidad border, to the Venezuelan border with ease, because remember, Dragon Field is on the Venezuelan side of things. Is it that we have to purchase this gas from them at a discounted price? If so, then what is that discounted price? Who's going to take what is the financial risk be involved, and who is taking the bulk of that financial risk? Or is it going to be shared evenly between NGC, Shell, and PDVSA in Venezuela? All of these factors involved, we have no clue about just as yet. So, however, what I would point out is that while the gas from Dragon should not be used or focused on as a lifeline, I hear people saying that's our lifeline for the energy sector here, for the gas sector. I don't think that's a lifeline at all, because our lifeline, what we should really be focused on, is what I just spoke about, ensuring that we can aggressively drive greater deep water exploration and production activities going forward. We're not going to see the returns from that until at least 5 to 6 years have passed, but the time to start is now. Dragon Field is only going to provide us a maximum that's at its peak. The peak doesn't happen every day. It's not even going to happen in the early stages. It's going to provide us with a maximum of 350 million standard cubic feet of gas per day. And that's only at its peak. It'll probably start off at about 170, 175 million standard cubic feet. So when it peaks, assuming that the gas production we have right now remains constant, that is only 2.85 billion standard cubic feet of gas per day. That is nowhere near what we need for our local usage, our local consumption usage. 2.8 billion standard cubic feet is far less than 3.5, which is what we were likely to need. And that is about 2 to 3 years into the future. We're not going to see that Dragon gas tomorrow. However, if it were to be successful, mm-hmm. if this entire deal comes off without a hitch and we were able to get this Venezuelan gas to Point Fortin at Atlantic LNG, process it and then use the liquefied natural gas for export purposes, then there could very well be other opportunities to monetize on Venezuelan gas as well. Given that, and it's a good idea, given that we have the infrastructure in the form of Atlantic LNG, and we would have already built at that stage the pipeline from the Dragon field to connect at the Hibiscus platform, the Shell Hibiscus field, and which will then take the gas to Atlantic LNG. Mm. Remember, the Dragon field is part of that Mariscal Sucre area on the eastern side of Venezuela. There are three other fields that are neighboring Dragon gas. You have you have Patau, you have Rio Caribe, and you have a third field called Spanish. My Spanish is not so great, I apologize. Mejiones. So those are three other fields apart from Dragon gas. And those total four fields combined has about 14.5 trillion standard cubic feet of gas. So once we can monetize the Dragon gas effectively and that deal comes off successfully, then what is to stop us from also being able to monetize gas from the neighboring fields? We could take advantage of it, given that NGC would have already had the pipeline there at the Dragon field, at least in the future. More than likely, that is what you're going to have to do to get the gas from Dragon field to Hibiscus, then to Point Fortin. So once that pipeline is there, we can utilize it. We may have to invest in some additional infrastructure, but the returns might very well be worth it. And that's just on the Dragon field, Mariscal Sucre side of things. South of the border, we have Laura and Manatee, and we also heard recent reports that Shell would have given the green light for the financial development, the green light for the finances, for the development then of the field. So, however, there's a hitch still where Shell still did not get, as far as I'm aware, the green light for the environmental clearance, the environmental certificate clearance from the EMA, and which is you know, they need to aggressively speed up how quickly they provide these environmental certificates, because it can take sometimes well over a year to get this environmental certificate. And if it takes well over a year to get that, that means that you're sacrificing your production, gas production, that field could have provided by well over a year. These things take time. We're not likely to see Laura and Manatee gas until 2028, 5 years down the road. However, so therefore, the time to start is as early as possible. Laura and Manatee has about 10 trillion standard cubic feet of gas, out of which only 2.7 belongs to Trinidad and Tobago. 7.3 is on the Venezuelan side. Again, if Dragon is successful, what is to stop TNT from attempting to monetize not only our side of Laura and Manatee, but also the Venezuelan gas, the Venezuelan share of Laura and Manatee as well? Once we have the capacity to do it, I think this is something that we should certainly capitalize on. That is good. That is not going to happen overnight. Again, that you're looking at about 2028 there. But again, it is something that needs to happen. You see, right now, globally, the geopolitical framework is so interesting, is so unique. President Maduro is in dire need of U.S. currency. The petroleum infrastructure in Venezuela, that entire sector, needs a significant overhaul. It needs a significant revamping. They require at least somewhere between 150 to 250 billion U.S. dollars just to upgrade and rebuild their petroleum infrastructure. You have petroleum fields languishing, gas fields and oil fields in Venezuela, just there sitting idly languishing because they don't have the finances, they don't have the investment finances needed for the infrastructure. So what Maduro has done, he has recently provided export licenses to two European companies, Repsol and Eni Spa from Italy. Reason being is that in the past, Venezuela, even though they're a well-known oil player, oil exporter, Venezuela does not export gas. They have two, the irony is that they have 203 trillion standard cubic feet of gas reserves, the ninth largest in the world, and they don't export any gas. So now the president has given permission, special export licenses to two companies to export that gas. And according to Venezuelan law, if you have to, as a foreign entity, if you want to invest in Venezuela, in their oil sector, you have to partner with PDVSA, the state enterprise. But if it's in gas, you can operate independently of Venezuela, of PDVSA. And that is what TNT needs to take advantage of. With respect to the gas economy, we know that Venezuela is in need of these investments. So therefore, once the Dragon deal is successful, we can certainly go on and progress into other projects into Venezuela to monetize their gas, which of course is certainly going to help us from an economic standpoint. Apart from the creation of jobs, it is certainly going to bump up our gas production per day, not just for our local needs, but more so for our export needs to bring in the much needed foreign exchange that we certainly want.
Dr. Arjun, when we have these discussions, usually we get into the very technical elements of them. And that's good, because we need to pick apart what's going on so that we understand in greater detail. But sometimes I like to, and as we wrap up, take the discussion back to the, and I don't want to use the term average individual, because I don't want to say anybody's better than anybody else or anything like that. But at the end of the day, a fiscal package, a budget, caters to how a country is run and the standard of living, the quality of life that people are going to enjoy or not enjoy for this fiscal year. To the many people listening to us from the various levels of society, what are some of the things that you think they should be looking on for or paying attention to in this budget presentation?
So certainly we have to look forward to see whether there are going to be any increases in our cost of living. I think that is what everybody is concerned about for several years now. What exactly is going to be done, if anything at all, to bump up our cost of living or provide ease to our current cost of living? So for example, is he going to remove VAT on certain other food items or necessary commodities, on like for example, pharmaceutical items? Is that on the agenda? I don't think he's going to do that, knowing their trends so far. But what one of the things I have been advocating for since the start of this year is that we take out VAT altogether because it's so administratively burdensome. It involves a lot of VAT returns to be repaid, and the government seems to be having a very hard time paying those VAT refunds. So just simply do away with it, this 12.5 VAT, and bring on instead a 6% sales tax, which is less administratively burdensome because you have no refunds involved. And the 6% sales tax is obviously far lower than VAT of 12.5%, and it's only going to be paid at the final point of sale of the commodity. You see, VAT is something that involves several processes where you pay VAT from the time you import the raw materials at the port and you bring it in at the port. You're paying VAT for those raw materials, and the manufacturer would then, after he produces the good using the raw materials, he will then have to he will then have to file then to the ministry for his VAT refunds based on the VAT he would have paid at the port itself. And then the individual, the retailer buying from the manufacturer, he would then have to file to the Ministry of Finance for a VAT refund based on the VAT he would have paid to the manufacturer. So it can be a long-winded, complicated process for those involved, and especially for the BIR so far for many years. They've had a difficult time with respect to the audit system that they have in place to be able to determine who needs VAT refunds and what is the adequate amount of VAT refunds what is the amount of VAT refunds that should be paid, because there can be some fraudulent practices with respect to the VAT refunds as well. You can take away all of that if you have just a sales tax and you pay the sales tax just at the end of the day when you buy the final commodity at the point of retail, and you make that sales tax much lower than what the VAT is. I was proposing a sales tax of somewhere between 6 or 7% instead of a VAT of 12.5%. It is going to be far less burdensome for the consumer because 6% is, of course, much, much less. But at the end of the day, the government is still guaranteed their stream of revenues from that particular consumption tax, and they don't have to then go back to the books and look at how much VAT refunds they have to pay to the country. That is one of the things I hope to see in this particular budget, or at least to hear that they're giving it some serious consideration.
And Dr. Arjun, it always is a pleasure speaking to you and getting your insight, because you're very thorough in how you deal with some of these matters. And that kind of approach is necessary in explaining to people what's going on and probably some of why it's going on, probably what are some of the things that we need to do to address them. And I'm positive that after the presentation today, we are going to need your analysis to guide us through some of what our Minister of Finance will be presenting to us today for the next financial year. I want to thank you for being with us here this morning and giving us your insight into some of these very, very, very interesting topics. Thank you so much for being with us once again.
Thank you very, very much for having me. And you know, the being thorough part comes from being a university lecturer at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very, I feel it's important to help the general public understand and have a greater appreciation for why things are the way they are, so that they can themselves sift out the nonsense that politicians tend to spew on a daily basis. Instead of just taking it at face value, they themselves can now have more information to think it through for themselves and decide, okay, what this minister is telling us makes sense and what this minister is telling us is utter rubbish. Mm. And we need to really rethink this entire situation.
Yeah. And I'm sure we're going to definitely need that sense and nonsense after the budget. So we'll have another discussion. Thank you so much for being with us once again here this morning.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day. Take care.